Hi, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Ann Arbor District Library. My name is Tim Grimes. I'm the manager of community relations and marketing here at the library. It's a whole new year, 2013. Lots of different events happening at the library. If you check out our website, aadl.org, you can find out about all the different events in January and February. But it's also a time when we see some of our favorite events and favorite series returning. And last year, the city of Ann Arbor did a wonderful series on sustaining Ann Arbor. There were a series of sustainable Ann Arbor forums. They're going to repeat it this year. It promises to be even better. And here to tell us about the very first presentation in tonight's series is Matt Nod, the environmental coordinator for the city of Ann Arbor.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. First of all, I'd like to thank the library. They've been an incredible partner with us. We had very successful forums last year. We decided a lot of people came out. We do it again. We're glad to have you out today. So again, I'm Matt Nod. I'm the environmental coordinator for the city, and I'm going to be the MC for tonight. Also, the folks to thank at the library, Josie Parker, the director, but Tim Grimes especially, for coordinating this, helping us set dates, getting the word out. They advertise in the Ann. I heard Tim on 107.1. It's just a great way to get the word out to the community. So again, thanks. I'd like to thank specifically Jamie Kidwell, our sustainability associate, for all her work on the sustainability framework and the forums, and Wendy Ramson, our head planning manager, for her work helping out. Also, the U of M faculty, city and county staff, local businesses, and nonprofits that we've reached out to and you're going to hear from in the next three sessions. I'd like to remind you, we do have to be out at 9. The library closes, so we're going to try and wrap up talks by 8:30 and have questions till just before 9. So tonight you're going to get a taste of sustainability in Ann Arbor. We can't tell you the whole story in one night, but we are going to give you several 10-minute snippets into some key areas and stories that we think you'll appreciate. Challenges the city's going to face, some of the good things we're doing, some of the projects we're working on to figure out what to do in the future. So first, we now have a sustainability framework. This was Jamie Kidwell's project. We went through the city's 30 active plans, found 225 goals, worked with city staff, city commissions, council, and these 16 sustainability goals are now formal elements in the city's master plan. So it's a kind of core framework that's going to help guide what we do in the future. Tonight, we're going to hear about one of those goals, sustainable systems. The goal is to plan for and manage our constructed and natural infrastructure systems to meet the current and future needs of our community. I didn't know much about infrastructure when I came to the city 11 years ago. It's incredible the lines of businesses we're in and the various systems that we manage and the ways we need to integrate it. We do a better and better job. It's not always perfect, but how to take an integrated and a systems approach to manage what we do. And I think that really is the core of sustainability. So these are the asset areas that we think about, the kind of hardcore assets. We have a capital improvements plan. It's up on the web. It's our six-year planning document for large capital improvement projects. And I welcome you to take a look at it. It now has a mapping feature associated with it, so you can see where these projects are in your community. For example, in our capital improvements project, the way we integrate things, we'll be talking about what are the street construction projects for the next year. But in that same room and participating in the discussion are the folks from the water system, because there's pipes in the road, wastewater system, stormwater system, the street trees associated with those streets, how are those going to be affected in any kind of reconstruction project, and also bike lanes, where are the opportunities to put in non-motorized facilities as we go into the future. This is going to slowly cycle through a bunch of the things we do. We make water, distribute drinking water, collect wastewater, treat wastewater, build new streets, repave streets, bridges. We have to inspect our bridges. And there's also, we collect your trash, we own and operate the transfer facility, collect your recycling, own and manage the material recovery facility. I think we also take every sixth grader through there. Compost, old landfill contamination, all our park systems, stormwater, conveyance system, two recreation, two hydro dams, two canoe liveries, and I think it is the largest canoe livery in the state. So these are just a few of the systems that we manage. So one of the challenges is, how do we do that sustainably? So tonight you're going to hear a little bit about what's changing. I stole this from the Union of Concerned Scientists. This is the graphic they put up. So in winter, by 2095, they predict we're going to be a lot more like Cincinnati. And our summers, by 2095, are going to be a lot more like Arkansas. So these are the kind of information we're trying to collect, integrate, figure out the best available science. And you're going to hear from Dan Brown from the University of Michigan, the GLESA project, on some of the weather changes we're seeing so far and some of the weather changes we are likely to see in the future. What kind of effects can we expect? The pictures on the left and the far right are Ann Arbor in 1968. We had a storm that took out Getty's Dam. My understanding, and I haven't seen the picture, but when you leave town on Huron, you go under a railroad bridge. It says 14 feet 8 inches. Anecdotally, I hear you could not get a canoe under that bridge during this storm. So these are real events that happen in Ann Arbor. We're going to talk a little bit about what you can do. Buy local. We have a lovely farmer's market with solar on the roof. Rain gardens, solar thermal, photovoltaics. How can we use more renewable energy in the way we provide services to the city? And how can we provide you with opportunities through EV charging, and places to park? So FYI, we have 18 charging stations in the city now, and the usage has doubled from last quarter to this quarter. So we're actually seeing quite a bit of use in those parking garages. We're going to touch on climate. You're going to hear some of that tonight, but we have a climate plan that was just approved by City Council, so I want to note that. A2energy.org is our kind of energy efficiency portal for the city. And if you go to A2energy.org climate, you'll find a copy of the climate plan. So I like this graphic. The big square is our total greenhouse gas emissions for the whole community. The orange up in the upper left corner is the city's greenhouse gas emissions. And ours has actually dropped from 2000 to 2010. The big block M, you can guess, is the University of Michigan. And all the rest of us live and do business, and that's the gray area, and that's the part we have to figure out. That's the challenge. How do we go after the greenhouse gas emissions in that gray area? So I'm going to touch on a few places you can go for more information. We hope your curiosity is piqued tonight. A2energy.org website. If you go to the city's website, a2gov.org/A2H2O, we'll come to our tap water program. There's at our parks area on the website, there's all our volunteer opportunities. And if you go to a2gov.org/SOE for State of Our Environment Report, you'll see 10 environmental goals and 60 indicators and our view on how we're doing. You can also go to a2gov.org/storm to find out about stormwater, or /recycle to find out recycling. There's a bunch more of those, but I just wanted to kind of remind everyone those are available. So after tonight, we've got three more forums. February 13th is all about economic vitality. We have these speakers confirmed so far: Mary Jo Callen from the county, Dan Gilmartin from the Michigan Municipal League, Paul Krutko, head of SPARC, which is our regional economic development group, Ingrid Ault from Think Local First, and Paul Saginaw, a founding partner at Zingerman's. I think folks know who Paul is. And also on the National Board of Directors of Bali, again, a local business organization. March will be diverse housing. April will be transportation options. We have an updated non-motorized plan that's coming out, and you'll be able to hear more about that at that session. So I will stop there and introduce tonight's speakers. We're going to have Dan Brown from the University of Michigan the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessment Project. It's a group we speak with on a monthly basis to kind of, they sit in that space between the wicked smarty pants climate scientists at Michigan and Michigan State, and those of us practitioners that have to install stormwater pipes and plant trees that need information based on these large-scale climate models. Rick Norman, our Director of Emergency Management, will talk a little bit about how to plan for emergencies. Jen Lawson will be giving a presentation and talking about our stormwater systems, how it operates, and how we're thinking about planning for the future. Crescent Slotin, the Systems Planning Manager, is here as part of the panel. And finally, Jason Frenzel from the Huron River Watershed Council, talking about volunteering and that system that helps support our community. So with that, again, I'd like to thank you for being here, and I'll introduce Dan Brown, who's our next slide.
All right, thank you, Matt. Thank you, Jamie, for getting us all organized. Thank you to the Ann Arbor Library. I'd like to extend a personal thank you to the Ann Arbor District Library. My wife can read incredibly fast. And I think over the time we've lived here, the Ann Arbor Library has saved us thousands of dollars. So needless to say, I'm a fan. But tonight I just want to talk about climate change and how it pertains to Ann Arbor and southeastern Michigan, and thinking about our region specifically. But first let me just briefly introduce what GLESA is. So we're one of 11 NOAA-funded, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration-funded research centers. We're sort of the only one in the Great Lakes, Midwest, or Great Plains region. And as Matt touched on, you know, we try to be a network of environmental, social, climate scientists that connect practitioners with scientists to help solve these real-world problems. So maybe the first point to mention that often gets lost in this discussion is you hear about global warming, global climate change a lot in the media, and at a global scale, the results are quite certain. When you look at the warming trend globally, it's a very certain result. When we look regionally, locally, things get much more chaotic. It's a much noisier signal, and there is less certainty. But there are still things that we can say very confidently. At the regional scale, natural variability plays a much larger role. And changes in land use, thinking about where parks are put in, where dams are placed, these can have great effect on how impacts of climate change are altered. And they have very great impact on a very small local scale. So I want to jump right into this. So this is the observed Ann Arbor temperature, annual average, going back to 1900. These are the actual averages of actual observations. The station's right up on North Campus there. So you can see, and the hashed line across the center there is the 1951 to 1980 average. So we're seeing something that is consistent with the global and contiguous U.S. trend, where we have more hot years later in the 20th century, early 21st century, and early in the last century, it was significantly cooler. So we are seeing something that's consistent with the global trend. Maybe the most striking thing about the Ann Arbor climate record is how precipitation has changed, particularly over just this last 40, 50 years. So we actually saw a slight decrease in precipitation compared to the 1951-1980 average up until the 60s, and then we've seen since then a dramatic increase in, this is total annual precipitation. So it isn't your imagination. We are getting a lot more rain annually on average. Ann Arbor has a particularly dramatic signal here, so this is about a 25% increase since that 5180 average. The surrounding area has seen also a significant increase, but not quite this significant. Southeast Michigan has seen about an 11% increase. So why is Ann Arbor so much higher than that is hard to say, but we are seeing this trend certainly in our local region and throughout the greater region as well. With this increase in total precipitation, we're also seeing a number increase in the number of intense storms, intense storm events. So looking at 3-day very intense precipitation events, we've seen really in the Midwest, even compared to the United States, a very dramatic increase in the frequency over the last century of these strongest storms. Something that's a little counterintuitive that follows this is that while we're seeing more storms and stronger storms, we're also seeing the risk of drought increase just like this year. So droughts that are like this year or perhaps a little less severe than this year could be more probable. The reason is that we're seeing, in effect, an intensification of the weather. So as more of our precipitation is coming to us in these stronger storms, most of that's happening during the wet months of the year, so fall, winter, and spring. But we're seeing a greater risk of drought in those summer months. So we're seeing more storms, more intense storms throughout parts of the year, but we're also seeing an increased probability for dry spells as well. Not surprisingly, as temperatures warm up, we start to lose our winter season. So this is looking at the frost period and this compression of these top two graphs. So this is date of first frost in autumn, date of last frost in spring. So this compression that you're seeing in these two graphs is effectively the shortening of winter. Starting at this gray band, that's when we're looking at projections to the next century. So far throughout the region, we've seen, depending on where you look, anywhere from just a few days loss of winter up to about 2 weeks, typically. Looking forward to 2100, we think we may see anywhere from 1 to 2 months of a longer growing season. So essentially 1 to 2 months shorter winters, if you can imagine that. So again, a very dramatic possibility for our region. And of course, as the winters shorten and the seasons change, we also see our snowfall and our precipitation forms change as well. So we're seeing more precipitation falling as rain instead of snow. We're seeing reduced overall snowfall for the region. We're seeing reduced snow accumulation, so less snow on the ground with warmer surface air temperatures. Something less important for this region specifically is that we are seeing throughout the larger region more lake effect precipitation events, simply because there's more energy in the Great Lakes, more evaporation, more moisture in the air to really fuel those lake effect precipitation. So just to quickly summarize the things we've talked about here. So these are the physical changes in the environment that are most significant for Ann Arbor and Southeast Michigan specifically. So we're seeing, and I've ranked these qualitatively just on my impression, from most confident down to least confident. So we're seeing warmer average temperatures. We have a high confidence in that. More specifically, we're seeing warmer low and overnight temperatures. We're seeing shorter winters, more total precipitation, with more of that precipitation coming to us in the form of these intense storms. And we have the risk for more extreme heat and drought, particularly in the southern parts of Michigan and the upper Midwest. Now, how does this translate to real-world impacts. You know, how are you actually going to see this? How is this going to affect your lives? Well, climate change does not tend to introduce new problems, but it amplifies existing problems. So where we see existing vulnerabilities, there's a good chance that we'll have an amplification of that problem as climate change continues. So the problems we have with infrastructure, flooding, extreme severe storms, damaged infrastructure just from severe weather, those problems with more severe storms could increase. Cutting across different sectors like public health and economic impacts, you know, we have greater risk of extreme heat as temperatures rise, so that's a public health issue there. Flooding and water contamination with more storms, and as flooding and water contamination increases, we have more extreme heat events that makes it harder potentially for emergency management to respond. Economic impacts, it really cuts across everything. The seasonality of what we do, when we do it, what we like to do. You know, should we go to the beach? Should we get out a snowmobile? Should we walk to the deli? Should we drive? All of these types of things are affected over the long term by climate change. And with that, I just want to make one closing statement. So LISA works with a lot of cities throughout Michigan, throughout the Great Lakes region, and you can sort of take comfort with all these challenges ahead that Ann Arbor is sort of the flagship for this region, along with Grand Rapids, in dealing with a lot of these challenges. So the speakers that you're going to hear from tonight will give you a very good picture of you know, what are some really good practices and projects to help deal with these challenges. So with that, I'll hand it back to Matt.
Thank you, Dan.
So next, I would like to introduce Rick Norman from the city of Ann Arbor, who's our new, been at the city about a year, emergency management director. And a couple of tidbits. So just a reminder, we had our first tornado ever in March, ever. That's when we had the huge rainstorm here in town. And also a year where we lost our cherry crop and the better part of our apple crop. So these are some of the things we're trying to figure out. How do we change the way we think, or do we change the way we think about how we manage our systems based on some of these changes we're seeing? So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Rick. And emergency management.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks very much. It's great being here. I've been with the city less than a year. The Office of Emergency Management, we plan for larger scale emergencies and disasters. I like to say we also plan for things that we hope never happen. And that's basically what we do. I'm located in the safety services area in the city, specifically within the police department. In my world, these federal agencies are concerned about climate change relative to disasters and emergency preparedness. You can see FEMA, the NOAA, specifically the National Climate Data Center, Department of Homeland Security, and also Michigan State Police. The Emergency Management Homeland Security Division has just released their draft copy of the threat and risk assessment for the state. And within that document, you will find several references to climate change relative to threats and risk within the state of Michigan. One of my major projects that I completed first when I started working for the city was completion of the first standalone hazard mitigation plan for the city of Ann Arbor. And within that plan, we define our population, our geography. We look at our uniqueness. We look at our infrastructure. We also look at the hazards that we are subject to. And we rank those hazards according to impact that they would have on the population. And then when we determine that, we start applying different mitigation strategies to those hazards as a planning tool to see what can we do, what can we accomplish to lessen the impact of these hazards on the city. By the way, mitigation means the things you can do to lessen the impact of a given hazard on a population and on property. So that plan has been completed. It's available online, and there'll be a handout tonight that has a link to that. But you can go and look at that document that's online now. Basically, in the emergency management business, we go through certain phases: prevention, mitigation, preparedness and planning, response and recovery, and then that cycle will return. So that's a real general overview of what we work on. Why are we concerned about climate change? And some of this has been mentioned already. The impact of disasters on life, safety, and property. The cost of disasters and the limited resources that we have. Interesting thing I heard this morning was that 2012 was the warmest year in recorded history, average temperature. The other interesting thing about 2012 was it is a year of 11 $1 billion disasters, or over $1 billion. The total disaster impact cost for 2012 in this country was $140 billion. The two largest disasters that comprise that number are the Hurricane Sandy. Second one is a national drought. So we've got the warmest year on history and a drought that was considered a major disaster in terms of financial impact. In terms of the Department of Homeland Security, which was on the other slide, Homeland Security is concerned about general areas that I can talk about, and that is population, population density, and critical infrastructure. Those are the areas to which Homeland Security is being funneled towards. So in terms of population, where are the people? In terms of density, how tightly packed are they? And then critical infrastructure defines the things that we need to maintain our life as it is and also to maintain the response systems that we have. Interestingly enough, on the presentation that Matt gave, there was a slide on systems. And within those systems that he noted, I roughly see at least half of those that are considered critical infrastructure to the Department of Homeland Security. So we're talking transportation systems, information systems, waterways, dams, bridges, that kind of thing. And that's what we're concerned about in terms of climate change and what is the effect on our infrastructure. The already crumbling roads, how much is that going to be accelerated by climate change? Health and disease patterns was also mentioned. Diseases will change. I want to back up just 1 second. In terms of population with DHS, one thing they're concerned about is by migration of people to other areas within the country based on the temperatures in the country. So they're protecting people in this area. If people are migrating to a cooler climate, maybe because it's too warm, then that's where the money has to be refocused on that population. Health and disease pattern changes. Are we causing things to, remember the pandemic a few years ago? Are climate changes causing temperature changes that are going to change those disease patterns, and do we have to start worrying about that kind of stuff on a public health basis? So for sustainability, I think what can you do and what can we do? You can become informed and prepared. You can become disaster resilient, and I would like to also mention we can try to help each other and help our neighbors and people that need assistance. In terms of the sustainability framework for the city, we're sort of addressing an engaged community and a safe community. So sustainability-wise, and as far as information goes, we have several systems in the city that we're using, and all these systems are places where you can go and get your disaster information. The Code Red system, which we have, is a very robust system that will phone call. We have a 1,500 call a minute rate, and it will inform you by analog phone and your cell phone what the disaster information is. It also does email and text. It has a robust mapping system. We can pull a small area on a map and inform just that area. We also use Code Red internally to call out our special teams, such as crisis negotiation and our SWAT team. We use it for that kind of stuff. I would encourage you to go online and sign up for Code Red and get your information in there. And when you do that, create your own account so that you can manage your own phone numbers and your phone number changes. I get calls occasionally. I don't know if I don't remember if I signed up for Code Red or not. Can you check for me? And I don't have access to that. I have to call the company, and then we have to find out. So if you create your own account, then you can manage that yourself. If you happen to put yourself in there twice, it's not a problem because it will not call the same phone number twice. So that can work. NOAA Weather Radio. I would encourage you to get a NOAA Weather Radio with a capability called SAME, which is same specific area message encoding. You get a NOAA Weather Radio, you put the Washtenaw County code, if that's where you live, in there, and it will, any alert that comes to the county will set off the alarm on your NOAA Weather Radio. We have a very robust siren system in Ann Arbor. We have 22 sirens within the city. But you need to remember that sirens are really an outdoor warning system. So there are occasions when you're in your home and you won't be able to hear them. What I like to say about sirens is when you hear them go off, go in and tune in and find out what's going on. You can sign up for a Gov Delivery, and you have a menu of choices that you can make within the city about information that you want to receive. Social media, there's a Twitter and a Facebook account with the city. And then we have our community television network and, of course, broadcast radio and television. We use all these sources for information. The trend in public warning systems like this is to integrate all these things together. And I would just say that you'll be hearing more about Code Red in the future. The other thing that's in public warning that's a trend is the use of text and, of course, using smartphone devices and other devices that you have. Text is a data burst that can get through even when the cell phone system may not be working. That was evident in the nuclear accident in Japan, and most recently, as was mentioned, the Dexter tornado. Cell phones were not working for a while, but text was working. So that's a good technique to use for public warning, and that needs to be integrated in this whole system. As far as preparedness, you've got ready.gov and the Red Cross website. Go on there and understand what your disaster supply kit should look like and how long it should sustain you without infrastructure or off the grid. Your communication plan, if your family gets separated in a disaster, there's a way to communicate with each other by maybe having an outside contact in another state. Be sure you have smoke alarms in your home that are working, you have an escape plan two ways out of each room, and that you practice and drill that. And I would encourage everybody to take training in first aid, CPR, and AED with the Red Cross. We also have community emergency response team training. There'll be a contact for that, where you will be able to learn a higher level of disaster preparedness. We have some members now that are part of the city team that are assisting with our disaster response. They work football games, art fair, and that kind of stuff. So that makes you more resilient disaster-wise. If you own a business, I would encourage you greatly to look at continuity of operations planning for your business. FEMA has those resources. And help your neighbors. Do you have elderly or functional needs down your street that you can assist during a disaster? City-wise, we drill all the time and exercise. We collaborate among all the emergency management programs within the county. We also collaborate regionally as our source for Homeland Security funding, grants, and training that we USC stands for Urban Area Security Initiative. That's our Homeland Security funding source. And that's it. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And I am going to put in a pitch to grab one of these handouts. So Code Red, the links to a number of the things that Rick talked about and our other speakers. We don't print as much stuff these days, but this will get you to all the right places. So thanks again, Rick. Our next speaker is Jen Lawson, who's our water quality manager for the city. Jen's in our systems planning group. For those of you that don't know, systems planning is a redesigned part as the city reorganized that tries to bring some of the core infrastructure expertise all together in one place. So water, wastewater, GIS, infrastructure modeling, energy, environment, capital improvements. And I've missed composting, recycling, and a bunch of others. But with that, I'll introduce Jen, and she'll talk to you about stormwater.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. I'd also like to make another introduction here for moral support, but also our unit director from systems planning is Crescent Slott, and he'll be joining us on the panel as well. Well, we just heard from Rick. Sure, I have these correct. Okay. We just heard from Rick about the city's responses to emergency management, and I'd like to delve in a little bit deeper and really talk about some of that infrastructure that the city owns, operates, and maintains at the benefit to the community, most specifically stormwater. So to familiarize yourself, this is a map of the city. North is up. The red lines are the freeways. The green lines are our major corridors in the city. But this is how I look at it. All of those green lines are the stormwater main network. The blue lines are open water. Keep in mind that those are only the city-owned pipes, not privately owned, no private development, not university-owned, not county-owned, not open water, state of Michigan. It's a lot of pipes. In fact, it's 231 miles of pipes. One of the things we deal with, though, when we start thinking of how to manage these pipes or how are these pipes sized, installed, and what's the best technology for some of this management techniques. When were they put in? Almost 20% of our pipes were installed before D-Day. Think about that for a minute. How many of you were even a gleam in someone's eye at that point? 75% of those pipes were put in over 30 years ago. Some of you, again, were still not a gleam in anyone's eye at that point. And then we do have another 25% of our storm pipe that's much more recently installed. We have a small amount, you'll notice, about just less than 5% that we have is unknown. And that's because we don't have as-builts, or we really don't know when it was installed. Now keep in mind, those are only those city-owned pipes. We can almost double that. We have 541 miles of stormwater conveyance in the city that is publicly owned. And by publicly owned, I mean university, state of Michigan, county, or the city. And that's open water also, so ditches and river channels as well. But that's 541 miles of pipe. So for reference, 231 miles of just the city-owned pipe, that'll get us almost to Chicago. 541 miles of pipe gets us to St. Louis. That's a lot of pipe to manage, inspect, and make sure it's functioning properly. One of the questions I always get is, oh, God, those pipes are kind of old, aren't they? Why were they put where they were? And one of the familiar terms, and for some of you in the room, maybe Allen Creek. This is a map of the city that was before 1920. I don't have an exact date, but I do know it was before 1920 because those blue lines are actually where Allen Creek used to be. And you can see that there are several fingers going right through downtown. For reference, I have Main Street, Miller, and Huron. Many of you may walk along these streets and notice, oh, there's a dip in the road. Probably because that's where the creek used to be. Anytime you look at a storm drain, anywhere downtown, it's going into what used to be Allen Creek. And we, typical of any sort of developing urban community, we put the creek in a pipe. Now keep in mind that creek still functions like a creek, even though it's in a pipe. When it rains too much, creeks overflow. What do you think happens to the pipe? When it rains too much, the pipe can't hold all of that rainwater, and so it does tend to overflow just like any natural creek would. So this is one of my favorite photos. This is what Allen Creek used to look like. This is looking north at Washington Street. Those two houses on either side are still there. So the gentlemen are standing on Washington Street. Now, when we put Allen Creek in a pipe, we didn't make a really big pipe at that point in time. We looked to see what fit. We literally went out, and then there are some of these timbers still in existence. What pipe fits underneath that already existing bridge in 1920, and let's fit the two ends together. And that is a lot of the system that we still are dealing with today. It's pre-1920s hydraulic design. Taking a step outside of the pipe, one of the things that we also have to kind of think about managing or think about what some of those impacts are to how the water gets into the pipe is impervious areas, impervious issues. Impervious, I have a nice Merriam-Webster definition up here, not allowing something to go through. So when it rains, if the ground surface is impervious, it runs off. It goes into the street, it goes into the catch basin, it goes into the river. It doesn't soak back into the ground like it did before this area was developed and settled. If you think about Allen Creek, and I'm going to refer to Allen Creek a few times just because it's really that downtown area that everyone's familiar with. Allen Creek is 50% impervious. So for every two raindrops that fall on that land area in Allen Creek, whether it falls out at Pioneer High, at the stadium, by downtown Home and Garden, or over by Argo Dam, for every two raindrops that fall, one of them goes right into our storm drain pipe. It's a lot of water for those storm drain pipes to handle. Another issue that we deal with stormwater management is flooding. Everyone's heard of the 100-year flood, right? It only happens once every 100 years. Not true. Science has indicated to us, as well as our own experience, that a 100-year flood really isn't the best terminology. It's not the best nomenclature for us to use. And so NOAA and FEMA as well have agreed on what they're calling a new term or a better term to use. And it's not the 100-year flood, it's the 1% chance storm. So in any given year, it has about a 1% chance of occurring. That doesn't mean that it won't occur every year. In fact, it's occurred at least once, to my knowledge, in this area. But taking that same science, a 10-year storm, which is what our pipes are designed for, a 10-year storm has a 10% chance of happening in any given year. And I'll talk about that a little bit because those are some of the numbers and the hydrology behind how do we design storm pipes, how big are they, what size are they, where should we put them to manage what's coming in off of those impervious areas that we're developing. So a little bit of history about the city's stormwater management system from a sizing perspective. Storm drains are not designed to pass every single storm that happens. It's impossible. We cannot build a system that's large enough to handle that. In fact, prior to 1980, the storm size varied, not because it was what pipes were available, but it's different technologies, new technologies. Every year there was a better and more accurate design. So since 1980 until now, we designed for the 10% annual chance storm, which again, in the old terminology, is a 10-year event. One of the questions we get often is, why can't you just build a bigger pipe? I don't understand. Just build a bigger pipe. Just do that. In 1998, the city worked with an engineering consultant to evaluate just Allen Creek, again, in that downtown area all the way up to Pioneer High area, just to build bigger pipes to design or to handle the city's current design standards, which at that time was, again, the 10-year event. That's not to prevent flooding. That's not for water quality. That's just that 10% chance storm. And in 1998, it was $41 million, and it would have torn up pretty much all of downtown. In 2012, that's $61 million just in a small area of the city. So when storms do occur, they do surcharge into low-lying areas. The streets, in fact, are part of the conveyance system to handle stormwater. Our stormwater inlets, so the grates that you see in the street, they actually are only designed to handle a 2 cubic feet per second capacity. And that's assuming that there aren't leaves blocking, there aren't solo cups blocking them, and every cigarette butt and all of the debris that's there. For reference, this is a pipe that was installed last summer on Stadium Bridges project. This was designed for that 10% annual chance storm, as well as what we refer to as the bankful rain event. And so if this were still a creek, the water would rise to the top of the banks. And you see the gentleman down there in the yellow shirt jacket? He's standing in a culvert that is 5 feet tall by 9 feet wide. And the access hole on the top is 9 feet wide, so we can get a vector truck down in the pipe to vector out any debris that ends up down in there. So I've talked a little bit about quantity. There are also regulations the city has to follow for quality. And really briefly, we had no federal regulation prior to 1970. The Clean Water Act happened in 1970. In 1990, the Clean Water Act was reauthorized, taking it from point source to non-point source discharge. Currently, we encourage low-impact development, which takes the water more at the source. And so how do we keep the water where it falls rather than pushing it to someone else and making it someone else's problem? In line with those stormwater regulations we have to deal with from the federal level, we also have state, local, and even county multiple varying regulations that we have to address. It gets a little bit messy sometimes, guys. So what happens when we get these extreme weather events? This was March 15th. This was the Dexter tornado. Looking at Depot Street, taken about 6 p.m., so just after the tornado kind of hit in Dexter. And you can see the streets are flooded. They're absolutely flooded. The stormwater surcharged out of Allen Creek and entered into our streets. So what's the city doing? What can we do about this? I've kind of told you the story of what are the pipes that we have. There are limitations to the system, and we know those limitations from a physical standpoint. The city is currently calibrating our stormwater model for a more exact understanding of how the system functions in these varying rain events, including that March 15th event. How should our system function, and where will the water surcharge out? We also, again, as I mentioned, work with low impact development. We try to deal with stormwater at the source, not only with developers, but also providing, using as a resource to the public. And we'll hear about that from Jason Frenzel in a moment. But really looking to our homeowners and our property owners, there's also some sort of responsibility and understanding of how stormwater does function. And I want to close with one question by show of hands. You guys have all seen storm drains in the road? How many of you guys know where they drain to? How many of you think you know where that pipe leads to? How many of you would believe me if I said every single storm drain in the entire city of Ann Arbor goes to the Huron River? That's a true statement. We do not treat anything stormwater-wise. Every cup of coffee you dump out goes to the Huron River. Every cigarette butt that you flick out goes to the Huron River. So there is certainly a connection that I think every single one of us walking on the way here, even from the parking lot, probably saw that connection. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. And now I'm going to introduce Jason Frenzel, but I'm also going to take a moment and introduce a couple of folks in the audience just so you know they're there. Councilperson Sabre Briere is here. Sandy Smith, who just left council, but I believe is still serving on the DDA. Wayne Appleyard, the chair of our Energy Commission. And Bonnie Bona from our Planning Commission. If there's any other commissioners that I missed, raise your hands. But I just want to make sure you know these are some of the folks that serve on the various boards and commissions that help make recommendations to council or act as council and help make those decisions that guide how we build and change this infrastructure. So with that, Jason Frenzel from the Huron River Watershed Council. He used to work for us, and he was stolen, but we're not bitter. So Jason.
How many of you grew up crawling through some of those pipes,
as I did?
Literally, over by Arborland. I should hire Lawson to do PR for us, I think. She's talking up the Watershed Council stuff really well. So I'm a professional volunteer manager. I worked for 10 years for the City of Ann Arbor in their Natural Areas Program, and now work for the Watershed Council. So my background is really strongly in volunteerism and that side of sustainability, because us as humans obviously have the ability to sustain our demographics, if not grow them. So we're continually part of the process, if not part of the problem. So I'm going to highlight a few things that we can do to be part of the solution this afternoon. And here's where I tell you what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about a few trends in volunteerism, just to give us a context of what's changing nationally, and then translate that a little bit locally, and then just give you a few more opportunities to get involved locally. A lot of this stuff that was described by Rick and Jen, they're big things, they're really important things, but being able to do something at home is really important also. And again, as has been said, a lot of those opportunities are listed on a handout that is on the way in. So feel free to grab one of those. Trends in volunteerism, episodic volunteerism, the one-time volunteering, short-term volunteering or being engaged is drastically becoming the norm. The time of our, parents and grandparents in this room, of people being involved at the church for their whole life for 20 or 30 or 40 years, those days are over. There are still some people, but the drastic, drastic amount of people are not involving themselves in the community in that way any longer. We are volunteering because something seems cool, because I have free time on Saturday, because the kids aren't at soccer practice this evening. I have some time to do something. So we're moving more and more in that direction. A couple of things to consider are the different generations that are upcoming and when they're going to have time to work in the community and work for us. The baby boomers are going to be an enormous amount of time invested in our communities as they are retiring now. So for the next 20 to hopefully 40 years, my mom is a baby boomer and she's in the audience, so hopefully it'll be at least 40 years. They will want to spend, studies have shown, they're going to want to spend, by and large, their time using their own expressed interest and previously existing expertise in the community in a way that shows that they've accomplished something with their life and continue that in an encore career, they're calling it. So how do we translate our work and our time and these issues that have been brought up? Maybe they can go and dig bigger holes for Jen, but I don't think that's what we're going to get out of them. Gen X, Gen Y, and the millennials are a really interesting group. They all have really drastically different psyches, as we've heard about on the news. Gen X is occasionally called the me generation. So we're going to have to prod them a little bit. But as they get older and move out of their 20s and 30s at this point, we're going to see really interesting things from them. The Ys and millennials are very invested in their communities and the good of the universe for different reasons. They're really active. They hear a lot through social media. And they understand what's going on. So capitalizing on those strengths and the fact that they're all going to want to be treated as individuals and not another person in the basement working at the potluck. again, corporations are changing the way that they're investing in our society. They have historically, some corporations have historically given a lot of money, and more corporations are tying their funding to their staff's volunteerism directly. And so paying attention to that, and there are a number of corporations in town, both national and local, that are doing this actively. Other impactful trends to pay attention to that I think are a little bit less about volunteering, but more about cultural norms that I think we should pay attention to. One is unemployment. We've had a huge amount of unemployment in the last few years, and that's reducing, thank you. That'll be really nice as that goes down a little bit more. But we've had just an enormous amount of influx of really strong, able-bodied, interested people volunteering to do things that they're really actively interested in, either to continue their career as they don't have a job or to shift their career because they need to go through a transition. And we're going to go through a transition again in the next 5 to 10 years where that shifts again as people pick up work and Michigan's economy starts getting going. Another interesting thing that I think Rick brought up that I think is really important is neighborliness and neighborhood cohesion. I heard a really interesting article that was spot on for me by Eric, I'm really bad with names, Eric Klingenberg. Title of a book that he wrote was called Heat Wave. It took two basically ideal neighborhoods in Chicago, socioeconomically really similar, during a really, really drastic drought. And one where this sort of shift in our culture into individualism was really, really present. And everyone was sort of disjunct. And they had one of, and it was also, both neighborhoods were disadvantaged in a series of ways. So this neighborhood, which was sort of disjunct, had the highest, or one of the highest, levels of mortality due to this drought. People don't have air conditioning and don't have proper access to water, and people die in droughts. There was a really similar neighborhood that had high levels of neighborhood cohesion, and they had the lowest level of mortality in their neighborhood, even though they socioeconomically were very similar. So social cohesion is also a really important thing for us to consider in responding to disasters, drastic climate change, and the like. So here locally, we have a lot of strengths to build off of, considerations to think about, translations of some of those national trends. My own background is, and our culture here in Washtenaw County has really, really strong volunteerism and engagement in parks and nature and rain gardens, the city's programs, the county, U of M, a bunch of land conservancies, a ton of great nonprofits, all supported in this one venue. And I think that it offers us a really interesting lens to translate into other areas of engagement in the community. Similarly, we have a very, very wide array of social service organizations, nonprofit and government, and the government supports the cities and the county support a lot of those nonprofits in coming and going in different years, of course, due to budgets. But lots and lots of opportunities to get involved and lots of things going on to help people that are disadvantaged. The University of Michigan, having amazing presenters and astonishing amounts of information in our community, as we all know all too well sometimes. And then neighborhood cohesion. I think that we in Ann Arbor have a great set of experiences about this. We have a burgeoning local food scenarios. We have the Water Hill and music things that are happening. Just a ton of different things that surround this neighborhood cohesion issue in my mind. And I think that those are really great things for us to capitalize on and work towards. So a little bit about what we can do. I think that there's an essential place for the city government and other large organizations to play. Obviously, Jen and Rick have their business hats on, and they're taking care of business, and I don't need to get in there, and I don't really actually need to invite you guys to dig holes for them. But I think a few things that the city or the large government, the large organizations could do. There are now 20, throughout the United States, there are 20 cities of service. This is a designation given by the federal government that a city gets, applies for a grant, and the federal government gives it to them, and they get a bunch of funding, and it's a restructuring issue where service and the community orientation is paramount within the organization as much as any of the other really important systems. Virtual volunteerism and micro-volunteering, so being able to just get out my phone and say, there's a picture of a broken something, and say, here you go. Now you have it. I don't have to call anybody and bother anybody with my code red question or my little tiny question. I can just pick up my phone and say, here, yeah, I saw a problem. You can fix it. It's your job. I know it's your job, and you'll fix it. And there are lots of systems that are like that are out there. The last thing that I think that the large organizations could do in town is an increase in collaboration, especially in philanthropic endeavors. The university, I love lots and lots of people at the university, lots of great friends, but they're the folks that take all the people with all the money, and the city has a detriment because of that. And so I would say that would be something that we should try to capitalize on as a community. Neighborliness and civility. A bunch of different neighborhoods have picked up this nextdoor.com. It's just a way to interact online with your neighbors. Fantastic tool. Try it out. If there isn't one, you just go there and you tell them, you drop your point on a map and you know if you have one or not, and you can create one. A couple other things that you could do for civility, bake your neighbor a cookie. And then the ultimate one to me is on the online forums, be a little bit nicer. But really what we can do on the ground, in our yards, we can grow food and buy food from farmers. We can keep rainwater. Unless you have $61 million to give Jen for Allen's Creek, you could put in a rain garden, plant a tree. Just keep the water that you're getting. It's totally possible on almost all lots. And lastly, volunteer. There's a list on that piece of paper, but there's 90 different locations, organizations in the county to volunteer at, across the board, all sorts of different things. You can work on storm water issues directly with the city or with the Watershed Council. And that's what I have.
So we ran over a little bit. I think we are going to take questions till about 8:40, as long as you promise me that you will not mingle here. You need to go to the bars or some other place to chat, or go to your neighbor's house, as Jason said, and mingle. Because we do have to be out of the library by 9. So while we're putting up the screen and arranging our panelists, a few of the ground rules. Please use the microphone at the back. We're recording this, and we want to hear who you are. I will put in an extra plug for Nextdoor. I set one up in my neighborhood. I live out by the Sister Lakes, and you guys can go ahead and on the west side, and we've got a group of neighbors that are interested in how are the lakes doing? Are they sedimenting in? What's the quality of lakes? And a lot of work got done in the 90s, but not much since. And so we're trying to see what are those tools and kind of local experiments we can do to kind of stay in touch. And I'm excited to see how that works in our neighborhood. For those of you that did not read the small print in the back, you have all signed up to dig holes for Jen. So anyway, I appreciate all our panel tonight. And I will moderate to the extent you've got questions on the topics tonight. I'd ask you to go first. If you've got broader questions about the city, we're happy to answer them, but I'd like to give folks who came to the topic a first crack at getting their questions in. So please come to the mic if you have questions.
Yeah, just step up to the mic right here if you have a question. Don't all rush.
We had to have piqued your curiosity about something.
I had a question concerning lawns, and whether or not there's anything being done to try and replace them, or what the city laws have in terms of what you can and can't do with a lawn in terms of stormwater runoff. And I mean, other than just having a little rain garden in one place, the weeds in my lawn looked so much healthier last summer than anything that was grass. So I'm just wondering, is there any kind of a program whereby you can replace your grass with native species or something?
Jason and I are up here actually trying to figure out who's the best person to take the question.
Or maybe both.
Maybe both. I can certainly start from a city perspective. We would definitely encourage some sort of vegetation. A lawn is better than nothing. We don't want the sediment and that soil running into the storm first and foremost. But a rain garden would provide not only the benefit to keep the soil on site, but to hold even more of the water. The city isn't going to necessarily pay for a rain garden, but we would provide resources on how to build a rain garden. The county, for example, Washtenaw County Water Resources Commissioner's Office, does have a program in, I believe it's called the Master Rain Gardener Program, where they will help you design and connect you with people who already have rain gardens who are willing to share plants. The big expenditure with the rain garden installation is plants and digging the hole. We won't dig the hole for you.
How about other native species, like grass that's 2 feet high, or a drought garden, per se? I mean,
I would certainly encourage that. We don't have any limitations on plant species.
So the city says nothing about your grass has to be cut at a certain level, or are there any rules?
We do have landscaping requirements, but the lawn requirements are different than a garden requirements. And a specific vegetated area for a purpose of a rain garden would not fall under those regulations.
What if I want to replace the whole half acre with native species?
We have several lawns in town that already do that.
Okay.
So we would certainly work with you and encourage that. In fact, to take it one step further, I know that there are several lawns that are entirely native prairie, and they coordinate with the fire department to do a burn once a year.
A couple other thoughts about that. So the only regulation that's really you want to be careful of in a residential situation in the city of Ann Arbor, this is different in other communities, is that your extension, the space between your sidewalk and your road, has to be below an average of 18 inches, I think now. And that's for site visibility for vehicles, okay, so you don't hit pedestrians. But on the main portion of your property, there really isn't anything stopping you for residential purposes. There's a bunch of other ordinances for...
Yeah, in a commercial development, the city would like to work with you. So a business, for example, we'd like to work with you on that.
And then a couple other resources for that. The county's rain garden program is fantastic. The master rain gardener program is taking accepting applications right now,
yeah,
until they fill up in the next couple weeks. The Stewardship Network is a local nonprofit that does a lot of work on this, as well as the local Wild Ones is huge. So, and those would all be great interactions. Sabre, do you have a comment about that?
Just a moment, Sabre, if you have one. Let's get the mic.
People who live in subdivisions may have actual rules within that subdivision about how they can garden and what their yard can look like. So if there are bylaws in a subdivision, they need to check those.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Just come right back here.
Hi.
Sean.
I wanted to know if there are any city regulations regarding gray water, if you're interested in doing gray water system on your property as a resident.
I could actually take that question as well, I suppose. We do have several Michigan plumbing code requirements that you would have to work with the city's plumbing inspectors, and it really does depend on the system. I do know that it's not looked upon favorably, but that's looking at older technologies. And so looking at some of the newer technologies that are available for gray water recycling, the city plumbing inspector is interested in working with someone on that endeavor. He and I had a discussion just before Christmas about this, actually.
My sense has been that in the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of the regulations throughout the states have been shifting, yeah, but that's slow.
Yeah, there's a couple of architects that are looking to build a kind of totally off-the-grid building, and we've been starting to talk to them about what kinds of codes they would bump into and what kind of flexibility we may have working with the code. So we'd be happy to talk to people about that. So I would just suggest if you're interested in doing something like that, talk to us early. Don't do it the week before you need the permit and to have your toilets work. So give us a little heads up. But, you know, we're certainly interested in pushing the envelope on some of these things. Some we have some control over, but, for example, we can't have a stricter building code than the state. So we would have required a lot more energy efficiency in Ann Arbor homes a lot longer ago. We're precluded from doing that. We also can't regulate pesticides in the city based on state law. So, Alice.
Thank you. I have a couple of things that are interrelated, but one is when Dan talked about the public assets and mentioned city buildings, I think we should extend that to city-owned property, open land, such as some of the sites that we're now seeing going under transition from use to use. And I noticed also that we had a lot of talk about the technological ways of addressing stormwater management and water quality. Those lands and others, whether they're public or private, can also accommodate other things than pipes. And I wonder how much we're looking at less technological, well, I guess pervious pavement would be technological, but mm-hmm. Things like supplemental systems, water, wetland restoration, ponds, daylighting and so forth, for filtration and so forth. So I didn't hear anything about that. I wonder what else might be going on.
I alluded to that in kind of an all-encompassing umbrella term called low-impact development, and that really does incorporate wetlands, prairies, wet prairies, riparian land management. And so the city does look, and we incorporate a majority of that into stormwater solutions. I can probably speak for myself as well as the philosophy for systems planning. I'd rather see the water stay where it falls and soak into the ground rather than pushing it into a pipe.
You might want to talk about, folks here may not know some of the actual projects we've done, or developers like 1618 Main Street. Mm-hmm. There's a new proposal for a development on Main Street where the Fox Tendon awning is. And there's a very large rain garden that's been designed for that site to have most of the water on that property infiltrate. The new City Hall building, the new Police Courts building. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. The new Police Courts building, the large silver building, as well as all of the land surrounding the existing City Hall, is what we lovingly refer to as zero runoff. So every drop of rain that falls stays there. We either reuse it, we allow it to infiltrate, we use it as art. But all of the wetland plants that are surrounding the building utilize all of that stormwater that does fall onto the property. So that's one example of where we're using municipally owned properties to address stormwater. And we certainly have looked through the CIP process at upcoming municipal building issues or problems that need to be addressed, and we've tried to incorporate stormwater where possible.
And I think we're developing a new green streets policy. We've tried a bunch of these things, and we're trying to better integrate it, get our engineers who build streets to think about each and every street rebuilding project, where can we infiltrate water there? There's this sense that, well, we can just infiltrate everywhere. We should put pervious pavement. And a good chunk of our neighborhood is full of clay. And if there's clay there, the water's not going to get down into the groundwater. So you really have to look at the soil-specific areas. But I think on the stormwater site, we've got examples of a easy street and a number of other projects. So if you want more examples, and maybe that's something we need to do, is a better map of kind of the green projects that we're doing throughout the city and highlight those.
I can speak to the next few major road projects that are coming up that you'll see construction barrels on. Forest Ave, 4th Ave downtown, Madison, those will all have stormwater improvement as well as stormwater quantity management techniques, including infiltration, but looking at street trees, how much water they soak up, looking at rain gardens, bioinfiltration, and infiltration ditches as well.
And Miller Avenue.
I'm sorry, Miller Ave is another one. And there was a rain garden installed when we did Dexter. You'll see in the Vets parking lot, the rainwater that falls on Dexter actually stops in the parking lot and infiltrates there in a rain garden. And the skate park is another good one, which is zero runoff. We have all of the stormwater falling on the skate park will be kept there on site and treated.
More questions?
I have a question.
Please.
This is kind of like for Dan Brown, environmental question. It's not really on the ground, stormwater, exactly, but it is. What about the impact of horizontal hydraulic fracturing on our local climate? That's really changing our state landscape if indeed the whole Lower Peninsula is a target for the natural gas companies to do horizontal hydraulic fracturing. What kind of impact is that going to have?
Well, the
and what should we do about it?
So, yeah. So in terms of climate impacts, so if there were any climate impacts, it would be hard to draw a line between what they do in Michigan on that to climate impacts in Michigan. Mm-hmm. In terms of groundwater contamination, other things of that nature that people are looking into and. Seeping into water supplies, those kind of things. I think the research is still going on in that. I know the Graham Institute right at U of M has been doing a lot with that. But in terms of climate impacts, in terms of altering the behavior of the physical things in the climate, mm-hmm. There would be no difference doing that in Michigan or doing it in North Dakota.
Well, I know, but I mean, won't it increase though? Because it would be accumulating effect. If North Dakota's doing it fine, they're not. It's not fine, but then if we're doing it here too, isn't it just going to increase the effect?
Is your question the fact that it's a carbon fuel and we're just going to be using more carbon fuel?
Oh, right, if we're just emitting more carbon.
Right. I just wanted to clarify what the question was.
And water pollution, too. Water pollution. Well, actually, and my other really big concern is water use, because each horizontal hydraulically fractured well is several miles deep, hits the shale, and then goes horizontally for a few more miles. And each well takes between 2 to 8 million gallons of fresh groundwater, and that's mixed with thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals. And that is pumped down into the well, and it's most of it, like over 50% of it, just stays down there. It's never, and what comes to the surface is just hauled off and stored in another injection well. So we're taking 2 to 8 million gallons of fresh water out of our groundwater supply for every single fracked well we do in the state. That's got to have some kind of impact on our groundwater supply. You know, that's my concern. My concern is, I know it's not happening right next to Ann Arbor now, but you know, we are part of the whole state. You know,
yeah.
So what
yes.
should we be doing in Ann Arbor, if anything?
So I will defer to what the Graham Institute has to say about that. I will say, in terms of water supplies, you know, our region is particularly resilient compared to the rest of the country. I think we're pretty, reasonably well protected compared to areas where water is more scarce. I would encourage you to check out what the Graham Institute at U of M has to say.
Yeah, because the Graham Institute is the place looking at fracking for the governor under the state right now. So that's happening. I think the broader question is, we don't have really good federal energy policy. We don't have good state energy policy at this point. And, you know, should we be spending dollars on carbon-based fuels with potential risks to groundwater when the cost for wind, the cost for solar, some of these things that don't pose those same risks are equal to or less than. I mean, natural gas is incredibly cheap right now, which is why there's this, you know, bandwagon. And Michigan also stores natural gas. If you don't know it, we have a large kind of salt domes in the middle of the state that when gas is cheap in the summertime, we pump it underground and then bring it back up and use it in the wintertime. So differentially, Michigan has cheaper natural gas than other states. So it's just a weird part of the way our geology is here. But next question.
My name is Els Niemenhausen, and I have a question about the demographic changes in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
As we heard before, the baby boomers are getting older.
That's me.
And that means that the baby boomers and the older population, we're only not getting older, but we also have difficulties in our functioning. There will be decreased hearing, decreased vision, decreased mobility, decreased cognition. It has major implications for a city like Ann Arbor. We know that Ann Arbor has been elected as one of the best cities to retire in. So that's great, and it is a great city to retire. However, Ann Arbor has not joined efforts to become an age-friendly city, and that means an age-friendly city where active aging is promoted, where aging in place isn't promoted, where all the resources are accessible for everybody, including people with hearing and vision loss. So my question actually to each of you is, how are you going to prepare for us, for all of us, getting older, and to become a real age-friendly city?
It's a great question, and I think our third forum is going to deal with aging in particular, but I'm not going to stop that from having
because there's still emergency procedures.
Absolutely. I just wanted to give a little teaser that those of you interested in that issue, please come back in March.
Sure.
So who wants to start?
Well, so I can say, in comparison to other cities in the region, Ann Arbor is really leading the charge in doing things that will protect vulnerable populations, aging populations, low-income populations. So they're really looking at the tree canopy, and Matt can say a lot more about that. So they're looking at increasing the tree canopy to provide heat relief. Ann Arbor is comparatively very good about, you know, providing cooling shelters and emergency management, things like this. So in terms of protecting, you know, vulnerable parts of the Ann Arbor population, I think Ann Arbor's doing a very good job. And as those risks increase, you know, we'll have to continue to do a good job.
Rick, you want to talk a little bit about emergency management?
Yeah, we have actually a small consortium several months ago where we're looking at functional needs, where that population is located, and what kinds of services they might require in terms of emergency response. So the first step in that, of course, is identifying who they are and where they are. And we have been looking at that actually as a group of emergency management within the county. So that's in place. And I guess I would also like to reiterate that our integration of warning systems, giving you multiple sources to find your information on disaster and emergency information. We work with the Red Cross all the time on shelter and shelter locations, where those are relative to the population. And with the integration of warning systems, we hope that that's accessible to everybody. There's multiple choices from broadcast television down to our specialized systems and radio. So that integration is also assisting people as far as any place they want to go to get their information should be available.
Chris, I'm wondering whether you might want to talk about transportation, crosswalk signaling.
I'm going to put in another plug for the April session on transportation. That I think that's a very appropriate session as well. That part of the areas of systems planning is our transportation programs, and in particular what comes to mind is the various mobility, transit in particular comes right to mind as to how do people get around, come into our community, move within the community so that those systems can be sustained for everyone in the community, regardless of their mobility issues, their socioeconomic situation. And so that's something that's very prominent in our group and the organization as well. And so I think both March and particularly even April on transportation itself is going to be a key item to get into some specifics on that as well. So that's very much in our forefront.
Jen, Chase?
I can kind of make an interesting statement. Water, the way the city manages water systems, and I kind of look at that as four different systems. We have drinking water, we have storm water, we have a wastewater or sanitary system, and the fourth system is the river, our natural water systems. It's the community as a whole, and so when we think of the different populations, it's my focus and really the focus on water infrastructure management is providing human and health services on all of those water systems for our entire population. So we do certainly make sure that we follow all state and federal regulations for drinking water. We make sure that sanitary systems are functioning properly and looking at capacity issues. Stormwater from a flooding and human health standpoint, and then the river kind of ends up being a little bit of everything because our drinking water comes from the Huron River. 85% of our drinking water comes from Barton Pond, and we also use that river for recreational opportunities. I'm not sure what the age limit is on the Cascades, for example, but I will tell you that I went kayaking with my 90-year-old grandfather this summer, not on the Huron, but you know, certainly recreational opportunities for multiple age groups.
Do you want to touch on this?
Well, not directly about yours or question or my area of expertise at all, but we do have 18 or 35 hospitals in the community, which is nice. Actually, I have family from throughout the state who come down to Ann Arbor for our hospital systems, which is always nice to have visitors. But as the community grows and changes, we are continually facing, as any organic organization has to change to deal with those growth patterns. And I see some work in the nonprofit world and the volunteer managers world, and as we interact with the larger organizations, to try to build new networks to respond to any number of things, including perhaps the things that you're bringing up. Not a solution as of yet, but definitely work in that direction by good people that are full of good heart.
I'm going to put in one last plug. We're going to have about six more minutes, but I'm going to take it. Plug for Ann Arbor Transit Authority. These are script tickets for A-Ride. So my mother-in-law lives with me. We had to buy a new house, find a place for her to live. She has memory loss, and the Turner Senior Resource Center has a memory loss group that she goes to 3 days a week. At 9:15 in the morning, an AETA cab from A-Ride comes and picks her up. They give her this coupon, and for $3, they pick her up and they walk her into the memory loss place, and I don't have to leave my job to do that. At 3 o'clock, they pick her up and they drop her off at home. Again, she doesn't have to carry cash. So we have some of these systems in place that when I moved to Ann Arbor, I had no idea they were there, but you look around and you find out these services. This allows my mother-in-law to live with us, and we can, you know, because of these services that are here in the city. So just put in that plug for the A-Ride system for anyone with elderly or disabilities. It's a great and easy system to use. So next question, Bonnie Bona.
Actually, I'm just going to do a quick follow-up on the previous question. This spring, the Michigan Planning Association hosted some conferences on aging in communities, and a couple of our planning commissioners attended, and related to the timing for the sustainability talk in March is we're bringing that conference to Ann Arbor. And I don't know the exact date, but I believe it's before.
February.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make sure everyone knew about that. So they want to, the ARA wants to come here too, because they want to see what we're doing.
That's great. Thank you, Bonnie. Okay.
This is really quick.
It's okay.
With regard to city land, is there any plan to reduce lawn mowing? Some of our parks have so much lawn, and I work for county parks, so I know how hard that can be to confront that issue, but I see these giant zero-turn mowers spewing fossil fuels, and I know that they're probably emitting, you know, really, really terribly compared to a car, and you just think, wow, that's a lot of lawn. And lawn's really impervious, right? I mean, I don't know what the runoff rate of is of lawn.
It's more impervious than other spaces, for sure.
Than other vegetation. I mean, it's pretty darned impervious for a green space. And I just wonder, you know, places like HCMA have done, certainly they've done programs growing, not mowing, where they really promote, hey, we're doing a great thing for the environment by mowing less lawn.
We've taken an interesting approach to that, and I'll use two specific examples. We do have to balance recreational need, and so we do have a lot of soccer fields, a lot of ball fields that the community does use. I mean, I don't know if you go down to ball fields anytime in the summer, it's really difficult to get on because we've got multiple leagues, kids' leagues, adult leagues, always using the mowed area of those recreational fields. But the two examples that I'm going to bring up, the first is Vets Park. In my short tenure here at the city, I think we've put in 5 rain gardens just in Vets Park. And by putting in those large area square foot rain gardens, we're not mowing it. And we're looking at it. And so it's a stormwater benefit. And that's really why we put those rain gardens in. But that is an area that doesn't need to be mowed. We've also reduced our mowing cycle. And so I believe it was once every 5 weeks. And now it's every 7 weeks. Or maybe it's 3 to 5. I don't quote me on that per se, but I know that we have reduced our schedule. The other one is kind of from another recreational standpoint. Over at Leslie Park Golf Course, the I don't know how many of you are golfers in the audience. We used to mow right up to the creek. More golf, more place for your ball to land, and we had some issues with bank erosion. And so through a drainage project, we are doing a floodplain enhancement, where we are almost, by a quantity of 4, widening the floodplain and reducing that extremely large area out of mowing. And you're familiar with the golf course. They're out there 3 times a week mowing, really mowing it short. That entire floodplain area is going to be native and maybe burned once a year, once it's established. And so from a golf course management standpoint, and that's a half mile of stretch, we are reducing it. Reducing that mowed area from a turf grass standpoint. So those are two examples I know personally in my short tenure here that we've looked at how can we reduce it, not only from the lawn mowing standpoint, but from stormwater improvement as well.
Okay, with that.
Wait. I've got one little plug I want to do. I don't know how many of you saw this little handy test tube looking doobobby out front. This is actually your own personal rain gauge, because I know many of you might water your lawn, or many of you might want to know how much rain falls in any given rain event. I would ask each of you to take one of these, plop it in your lawn, and you know, keep track of it, make sure the dog doesn't carry it away. But inside is a little tidbit of information, including an opportunity for you to send us your observations of stormwater behavior on your property. As many of you may know, if we get an inch of rain on the north end of Ann Arbor, we only might get a half inch of rain on the south side, and we are monitoring and tracking that through our stormwater calibration project. So there's a QR code on here as well as a little email. I would love to have some on-the-ground information, or if you just want to use it to monitor how much irrigation your lawn might be using as well. So thank you.
So with that, thank you, but also thank our presenters, and thanks so much for coming out tonight.